Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Ladies Who London podcast. I'm Emily Dell.
And I'm Alex Lacey, and we're qualified London Blue Badge tourist guides.
Each week we bring to you some of the best bits of London.
We talk about our favourite people, places and events with a bit of information, a lot of laughs and a whole lot of fun.
We can be found on Instagram at Ladies Who London Podcast and on our websites guideemily.com
and alexlacey.com for information about our upcoming walking tours and virtual tours, as well as what the Blue Badge guiding qualification is all about.
Yay!
Yeah. I made it.
Points.
I did it.
You made it all the way through, Alex.
I didn't mess it up this week.
Hurrah, hurrah.
Wonders will never cease. How are you?
I am very well.
Good.
I am very well. Feeling good. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good, you know. Chugging along. Things are starting to open up, which is really exciting.
Yes.
Yeah, and I've got my walking tours up and running and bookings are coming in, so that's really good.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yes, it would be quite strange, won't it, seeing shops open and pubs to sit outside and things. It would be, very different.
Yeah, I think it would be really different. And, it'll be weird sort of going back to that after so long and seeing London opening up. I don't know. It's going to be slightly weird, but very good, I think.
And it's been a bit of a strange week, isn't it? There was some news.
Yes, we definitely must address the bit of very big royal news that happened this week, which is that we lost old Phil.
We did.
At 2 months shy of his 100th birthday. Which is a bit of a shame because when people in the UK, actually I think it's Commonwealth as well, reach 100 years old, the Queen sends them a telegram. And I really love the idea of her just rolling over in bed and going, "Morning, Philip, there you go," which would be rather lovely. But was not to be. Yeah, good old Phil.
What do you think that's how she'd say it?
Oh,
good morning, Phil. Here you go.
It's like she's in the room when I'm doing a Queen impression.
Hello, Phil.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, goodness. I mean, not really a shock because he was 99.
Exactly. But still, it's, you know, it's a big thing and all the flags are at half mast. It's
there's nothing to watch on the telly.
Nope. I just watched a bit of football and Tottenham and Man U did their 2 minute silence. Yeah. Sorry, I don't know why I brought a football link in, but there you go.
Yeah. So definitely end of an era, isn't it? And I guess it's always really interesting to think about this. And in terms of us, it's, you know, Prince Philip, and he is the Prince, the Duke of Edinburgh, sort of in some forms a sort of, I wouldn't say celebrity, it's not quite celebrity, but we've got to remember he's somebody's father, husband, grandfather. And so for the royal family, even though they are an institution and they are sort of almost a kind of celebrity level people knowing about them, ultimately, they're still a family and they've just lost the patriarch, really. So,
exactly. Yes.
I kind of want to give the Queen a bit of a hug. I want to go and give her a big hug.
I've always wanted to give the Queen a bit of a hug. And I was trying to think earlier, you know, have I had any connections with Prince Philip? Have I met him? And the instant answer was obviously no.
I met him. I met him at a Duke of Edinburgh award.
Did you?
Yeah.
Do you know what? When I thought this earlier, I thought, I bet Alex has met him. Did he go to your 30th birthday?
Yeah, briefly. He came and it was for the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme, which, if you're not from the UK, it was a thing that he set up to essentially kind of encourage young people to do loads of stuff. So you have to do a skill and a sport and a bit of community service and all kinds of different stuff. And there's different, you know, gold, silver, and bronze. And when you get to the gold one, You get to go to one of the royal palaces and have your the badge given to you by I got chatting to Linford Christie at the one I went to, which was brilliant.
Oh, fantastic. But then
good old Phil used to sort of pop up and have a chat with you. So he came and kind of had a chat with our little group, very briefly, in a sort of...
Oh, see, that's where I was going wrong. I never completed it. I did my bronze and silver and just kind of got distracted. So it's the gold where I needed to be.
A lot of people half-assed the gold. And the gold, the gold took quite a lot. You had to... Everything that you did, you had to do it for longer or for better or whatever. And so it was quite an undertaking. And a lot of people, I think, sort of half did it and then left school and never quite finished it, which is totally normal. And I'm not a quitter like you, Em. So
I tell you, I probably just didn't do it because I had better things to do, like the washing up or something.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, it was great. I was more excited really about meeting Linford Christie, but yes. Yeah. So I did meet him very, very briefly in a very sort of passing way.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, there you go.
But my dad knows, and my dad's got stories about him, because my dad, does a bit of work for the palace at times. So he's met him on several occasions. And had
dinner. Oh well, we've got to get these stories, Alex.
Yeah, maybe I'll write down onto the podcast next week, and he can tell us about Phil.
Yeah, great. Right. So wow.
Well, adieu, Phil. It's been fun.
Indeed.
Yeah. There we go. Right. Well, let's pick up the mood a little bit.
Yes. So last week, what did we do?
I don't know. What did we do? Oh, it was the smog, wasn't it? It was the smog.
Yes, it was the smog,
Honestly, I've got goldfish memory. I can't remember.
What a smoggy brain.
Yeah, definitely a smoggy brain. And on that note, I did get a little message from Hannah, who is a listener, who has actually been following me on Instagram for about a year now. We're kind of Instagram.
She's not following me. Can I put a plea out there, Hannah, whoever you are, can you follow Guy Demily as well, please? Actually, can you all follow Guy Demily?
I suspect she
probably is. Lacking on the old followers.
I suspect she probably is. But we got a message from her, and she said, after listening to the podcast about the smog, she asked her dad about it, because he grew up in Hertfordshire, and he was 10 at the time. And he said, this is a brilliant story, he says that he remembers hiding in someone's front garden as he could hear footsteps coming through the fog, but he couldn't see who it was. So he was, a bit scared. And he waited for them to go by, and then he made his way home. And it turns out it was his dad who'd gone out to find him.
Oh.
Oh, so that's how the smog was. All out, in Hertfordshire, not even in London, and couldn't even see.
Just to hear the kind of the tapping of the shoes going past.
Yeah.
Wow. If anyone else has a smog story, can you please send them in?
An old smog story, we love it. So thanks, Hannah. That was a good one.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Hannah.
Amazing. So we should probably find out where we got to on ye oldie podcasty pedestal from last week.
Yes, I have to say, when I wrote out smog taxi dude, I thought, well, this is obviously going to be something that people want to go for. Smog taxi dude. I mean, even if you didn't listen to our podcast, you'd be like, "Yep, having that one."
I didn't think you were actually going to write that though.
Yeah, and if people didn't know the podcast, and they probably thought that I should have put smug taxi dude and accidentally put smog. But either way, I think it was getting a vote.
Are you just trying to build up to the fact that you don't think you've won this week?
I don't think I've won this week. And you're right. I do think that because of the way that I wrote it, smug taxi dude, which obviously is something that you said, I'm not completely taking everything for it, but... smog taxi dude pickpockets. I know which one I'd go for.
You'd go for smog taxi dude, wouldn't you?
I would. In fact, I think I did.
Well, so it was definitely not as close as it has been in recent weeks.
Mm.
It was 33-52. So that's a bit of a chasm there.
That is, because it's been, we've been one away or four away, and wow, that's a big drop.
And the winner was you.
You are kidding
me.
Yeah,
I am kidding. It was me.
Oh! I was so sucked in then. Sucked into the fog.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, God.
Yep. Bringing it back. Shock.
Yeah. So now it's 15-12.
15-12. Jesus Christ. Which are the Tudors.
Oh, amazing. Dear me.
Well done. Well done. Thank you very much. Thank you. I will take that win.
You deserved it.
I'll be very well gracious deserved. In that win and yes. Not at all rub it in your face.
No, I do think pickpockets were a good one.
They were.
The stories of pickpockets, but you've got to be clever, in terms of how you write it on the poll, I think. So I should have, Gary the pickpocket or something.
Pickpocket dude, pickpocket swung.
Pickpocket dude. That might have swung it for me, but there we go.
Hey ho.
Hey ho, well done.
So this week, where did it land? Trafalgar Square, wasn't it? Yeah.
Was it Trafalgar Square? Yes, it was Trafalgar Square.
So I picked, and I'm slightly going just off the corner of Trafalgar Square. I'm being a bit cheeky because there is Coutts Bank just around the corner. And I did promise you a story that my friend had told me about Coutts Bank.
About that. Yes.
So Coutts Bank, for those who don't know, it is it's a very, very prestigious institution. It is obviously a bank, and it's where the Royal Family bank, and you know, the Queen Mother left a massive overdraft when she died there. Like it's a pretty big institution, and it's got philanthropic links and all this kind of thing, but ultimately it's a rich people's bank. And a friend of mine many years ago didn't know this, and she was sort of wandering through London and she needed to open a bank account. She sort of tootled on into Coutts and said, you know, I'd like to open a bank account. And they were like, oh, yes, absolutely. So, you know, sat her down and gave her a glass of champagne and this, that and the other, and tootling around and all that kind of thing.
Get this at Barclays.
Yeah, right. And they sort of got to the nitty gritty of it. And they sort of said, you know, how much are you starting the account with or whatever? And yeah, she was like, a few hundred quid. And they kind of rather sort of delicately had to say, well, the minimum you can start an account with is £500,000. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Did she suddenly say, can we change this to the Prosecco, please?
Yes. She didn't open an account there. What a great thing. Sort of going.
That's such a good thing to know. So if you're wanting a little glass of bubbles, you know, and you're quite a good actor, pop yourself in there.
Exactly. So they obviously hadn't figured that out or chat told them, you know, what her kind of her budget was or anything. Hilarious. But anyway, so that's Coutts Bank. So I've taken that as the jumping off point for a lady that I found out about a couple of years ago, and I'm just fascinated by, because she is so good and she is so funny. Well, I say funny. I don't think she was... I mean, from all accounts, she seemed to be like a bit of a wicked laugh to be around. But her story is utterly brilliant, and I just think it's very entertaining. And she's really interesting. So I'm going to talk about Angela Burdett Coutts. Mm. So the Coutts name, obviously, linked to the bank there. And her date's 1814. She's born in London. She's, you know, London throughout her whole life. And she dies in 1906 at the pretty decent age of 92, which is not bad, really. Not bad. So Angela Burdett Coutts, why are we talking about her and what makes her so interesting? She is a woman who goes really, really against the grain of everything that women are expected to do in the Victorian period with her money. So to go back to the very start, where does the Coutts link come from? The Coutts, Thomas Coutts, who set up the Coutts Bank, which is still obviously going today, was her grandfather. Hmm. Her mother was his daughter, Sophia Coutts. And he, you know, Coutts had set up this bank and become extraordinarily wealthy, like really, really wealthy. And Angela is the youngest of six children born to Sophia Coutts and her father, Sir Francis Burdett. And he was a member of Parliament. He was quite radical, actually. And this is where Angela gets a bit of her kind of radical. She's essentially a radical philanthropist, really. And she's born on Piccadilly in 1814. And she's brought up in this family with five brothers and sisters. And her father is busy as an MP, kind of. He's introducing motions for parliamentary reform, and he's trying to expose government corruption. He's campaigning against the slave trade. He's campaigning for philanthropy and all this kind of stuff. So he's
good man.
I mean, right? Yeah, we're liking him. He's good. Yes. Although I'm just going to throw into the mix that he had been having a few affairs. And actually Angela is the outcome of the first, she comes from the reconciliation between him and Sophia after he's had a pretty disastrous affair. So they get back together, and Angela's then born as a sort of, you know, peace treaty, if you like, really.
And do they stay together ever since?
I think they do, actually, yes. And they only die a couple of days apart, and they are buried together. So I think that they were still married for the whole of their lives. I didn't kind of go all the way to the end of their lives, but they're definitely sort of together for most of it anyway. And they are, and of course, you know, Thomas Coutts, this chap who's owning this bank, is not particularly pleased about all these massive high profile affairs and all this sort of stuff. So he's always a bit sort of side eye about his son-in-law, and it's, you know, a slightly fractious relationship right there. But one of the things they have is very, very good links, as you might imagine. They've got Queen Victoria as a family friend, and they're moving in the real upper echelons of society. So they really are definitely the aristocracy. They're high up there. And this is where Angela stays throughout her life as well. Now, her grandfather, Thomas Coutts, had got remarried to a woman called Harriet Mellon, who was a lot younger than him, massively, you know, tons and tons of years younger than him. And in 1822, Thomas Coutts dies, and mm-hmm. he leaves his entire fortune, his whole estate, to this new wife, Harriet Mellon.
Gosh.
So to start with, so essentially, Sophia, Angela's mother, doesn't get anything from her father. And originally she sort of thinks, well, I might take this to court and I might oppose the will. But in the end, she gets a bit of legal advice and they sort of say, look, you haven't really got a leg to stand on because women didn't. So she gives up on that. But Harriet decides, now Harriet's the Duchess of St. Albans. And she decides that when she dies, her money that she's got from Thomas Coutts is going to go back into the Coutts family, which is, quite a lovely thing, actually. And so she decides she's not just going to give it out willy-nilly. She's going to figure out who to give it to. So she kind of takes a close look at the grandchildren over, a number of years. She watches what they're up to, and she sort of, she takes a lot of interest in their lives and decides who it's going to go to.
And did the grandchildren know? Would they have been aware?
I don't know, actually. I don't know. Possibly not.
Because otherwise you can imagine sending gifts and, making sure they're as good as gold.
Well, so Angela, fairly obviously, because she's the subject of our story, it's like films where, stuff is going to happen. You're like, I wonder who it's going to happen to. Could it be the protagonist of the story? Angela is obviously going to get left the money. But when it is announced that she's inherited that money, that's quite a shock to everybody. Mm. So whether or not they knew it was coming back to the grandchildren, I don't know. Whether they certainly didn't know that it was going to go to Angela, put it that way. So,
God, and so it all went to Angela.
Right. So, yes, pretty much most of it anyway. So one of the grandchildren is a guy called Dudley, and she's looking at him going, yeah, he's pretty decent. He works really hard. He's got good morals. But then he does something slightly stupid. He goes and marries a lady called Christine Bonaparte. Mm. Know that name?
Yes.
Yes. She's the niece of Napoleon Bonaparte. Okay. And at this point, Harriet is like, no. So she cuts him out. She's not interested in giving him money. There's a couple of others who are in the running. But essentially, she looks at Angela. And Angela's been really... She's sort of taken on a companion role to her father. She's been very, very trustworthy. She's met some really interesting people. She's getting really friendly with William Gladstone and Benjamin Disraeli, who are... going to go on to be big politicians. Mm-hmm. And she's got links, through her grandfather's links and all this, she's in with the European royalty and the nobility and all this kind of stuff. So when Harriet dies, the will is read out and everybody's really shocked that the entire estate, or pretty much the entire estate, is left to Angela.
You would be, wouldn't you? I mean, if you were another one of those grandchildren, you would be like, what the hell? You'd be like, couldn't you just divvy it around, fair and square?
Yeah. So this is where Angela does do this a little bit. She gives her mother an allowance of £8,000 a year.
Oh.
And she gives her sisters an allowance of £2,000 a year each. So actually, Angela is not one who's going to grab the money and run and say thanks, She looks after them, which is really good.
Okay, good. Maybe Harriet knew that.
Possibly. I mean, chances are, yeah. I mean... it might have been the thing of, if I give it to this person, they're going to squander it. But if I give it to Angela, I know that she, her morals are right. She's going to look after people. Maybe that. We don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it proves to be completely true. So to give you a little bit of a sense of how much she's been left pretty much the entire estate. She becomes, so it's in 1837 that she inherits all this money. And after Queen Victoria, it's said that she is the wealthiest woman in England. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's about 50% of her grandfather's fortune. So obviously his wife has spent quite a lot of it. But then what's left, she gets the majority of it. And she gets about £1.8 million, which in today's money is about £170 million. So that's a lot of money. Wow. Huge amount of money.
I mean, what would you do if that suddenly came to you? I mean, she was obviously quite well off anyway. It's not like she was ever ever gonna, you know, open the wrong door, so to speak. But wow,
I know, quite mad.
How old is she at this point, Alex?
So 1837, so she would be about 24. Yeah, right. So yeah, so it's pretty decent, isn't it? It's not a bad thing to come into, really.
Pretty decent. Gosh.
One of the great things, there was a newspaper that decided they were going to tell people how much the amount that she had come into, how much it would weigh. It's so weird.
Money would weigh.
Yeah, right.
And what did they say?
So it says the weight in gold is 13 tons, 700 weight, 3/4, 13 pounds. And it gets even weirder. They go, it would require 107 men to carry it, supposing that each of them carried 289 pounds or the equivalent of a sack of flour.
What? Why do people need to know that?
Weird.
I'm really glad they put that in, because I was about to question how many men it would take to actually lift the thing.
But there are a couple of stipulations that come with this, and they're slightly weird ones. Firstly, I mean, actually, this one's not really so weird, but any successors to Angela, so children or whatever, would mm-hmm. take the surname of Coutts. So the name has to kind of carry on.
Mm-hmm.
But the weird one is that the inheritance is conditional on her not marrying a foreign person.
Oh.
Yeah.
Harriet, a bit of a xenophobe.
Possibly. I don't, it might be, they wanted the money to stay in the country. I don't know what the reasons are for it. I don't know whether that was her grandfather's stipulation. Who knows? I don't know.
Just worry that the bank might suddenly, I guess if they marry somebody from elsewhere and maybe Angela decides to move. Yes, I guess. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So
what would you think would happen if suddenly a 23, 24-year-old woman it comes into a vast amount of money. What do you think the society is going to make of that? Who's going to come sniffing?
Well, let's say that her doorbell is going to probably catch fire, because there's going to be so many people buzzing the hell out of it.
Absolutely.
Yes, there's going to be all sorts of people sniffing around, isn't there?
There is. And there's a huge... And it's funny, because up until then, she was described as being sort of a bit plain and a bit lanky.
Oh, no. So suddenly she's got a little bit of change. And
exactly.
People are
suddenly
like,
people are interested in her.
Oh,
and
no.
She sets up home in Piccadilly, and all of a sudden she's got a swathe of people who are all trying to win her hand, and you know, all of this plain and lanky thing doesn't really seem to matter and whatever. And she gets really quite sort of just bombarded with offers of marriage from left and right, from, you know, all over the place, and it's quite bizarre. And in the end, what she does is she's finding it just all a bit too much. She has no intention of getting married. She's not got any interest at all. And she writes to a family friend who is also involved in the Coutts Bank, and she says, you know, she kind of asks for help and says, look, you know, this is flipping ridiculous. Could you sort of help me deal with all of this? And her dad finds out that she's written a letter to this guy, and he says to her, I'm a bit peeved that you didn't tell me. I could, if you'd have told me that it was such a problem and such an issue, I'd have put a stop to it. Like, so her dad is properly being an epic dad here and just going, why didn't you tell me? I would have knocked their heads together. You know, like, really,
yeah,
really good.
Yeah.
Really good. And there's one guy, and this is a bit creepy, this is a bit kind of hashtag me too-y. There was one guy called Richard Dunn, and he was a failed barrister, I think. He was bankrupt, whichever way he was bankrupt, and he has obviously taken a shine to Angela / her money. And he essentially, wherever she went, he popped up. So when she went up to Harrogate in Yorkshire, he followed her up there. Mm-hmm. When she was at her home on Stratton Street, which is just off Piccadilly, he would take a room in the nearest hotel. When she went out walking in the parks, he would suddenly appear. If she, you know, would go to a private walled garden or something, he'd be peeking his head over the wall and waving at her, or kind of trying to get through the hedge.
He even
managed to get into her home and leave his business card, his visitor card, in her sitting room. And she essentially, what she ended up having to do was to constantly have policemen in her hall and servants and stuff whenever she was going anywhere, sort of fend him off. Super creepy, like properly.
So suddenly, you know, all this money, all this wealth,
yeah,
is causing so much drama for her.
Massive amounts of drama. And she decides that she doesn't want to get married. And social convention was such that a woman couldn't really engage in business. She wasn't allowed to. That was social convention. That's not something that you did. So Angela thought, well, so she'd been brought up in this pretty radical family. We heard what her dad was involved in, fighting against the slave trade, fighting against poverty, all this kind of thing. Mm. And she goes the same way. And she's sort of backed by him the whole way. Whatever she's doing, he supports her. And she basically goes, right, I have this massive whack of cash, more than I will ever need. And she decides to start giving it away.
Yes.
To good cause. I know, she's brilliant. So I absolutely love her. She turns to philanthropy, essentially. And she starts giving out money to a whole variety of good causes, particularly when it is linked in with relieving poverty. That's something that she's really, really passionate about. She, in particular, East London, she helps redevelop areas such as Bethnal Green. She builds homes for the poor. She pays about £7,000 in money back then to install a new freshwater drinking fountain in Hackney Park. Oh, wow. Sorry, Victoria Park, which is in Hackney.
Yeah.
And what she gave money to was massively diverse and hugely, hugely generous. She gave financial support to wives of soldiers serving in the Crimea. She actually bankrolled Florence Nightingale quite a lot with loads of equipment to improve hygiene. And she supported army hospitals. We talked about Florence Nightingale a while back, didn't we?
Mm.
And Mary Seacole. And she was supporting army hospitals and things like this. And essentially, she sort of threw money at anything that she thought was worthy. And again, quite radical. She was massively concerned with child labour. So she was worried about these kids going out and working and the poverty that they were living in. She was funding schools and evening classes and trying to give children from deprived backgrounds the ability to earn a living.
Oh, God, what an incredible lady.
Oh, I mean, absolutely amazing. She was one of the first people to support cancer research as well. Quite fascinating. She gave the Royal Marsden Hospital, which is very well known for its cancer treatment even now, she gave them an interest-free loan. And then she also carried on supporting them every year with an annual payment of £50 as well. She gave huge sums to relieve poverty in Ireland. There was the potato famine. The effects of that were widespread, and she was giving money to that. And in particular, she was giving money to fund places where you could get the kind of things that you needed. So corn and flour and tea and sugar and all of that, you could buy it really, really cheaply because she was sort of bankrolling it.
Mm.
One of my favourite things that is quite interesting, she loved animals. And one of the things that she did, her father actually had been the first politician to sponsor the first act against cruelty to animals, which is, again, you know, for Victorians, like, they don't really care about the, you know, the lives of the animals. They don't care about how well they're being treated. So this guy's stepping up and saying, you know, I think this is an important thing. And she follows suit, and she is made president of the Ladies' Committee of the RSPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And one of the things, she was really closely involved in that. And it, from doing that, she helped the RSPCA kind of become what it was today, or what it is today, rather. And she sort of put the founding into that. Have you ever been to Edinburgh?
Have I been to Edinburgh? Yes. Yeah.
Do you know the statue of Greyfriars Bobby, which is on the George IV Bridge in Edinburgh?
And potentially. I've only been there.
The little terrier. And he, the story goes that his master died, and he then every day would basically guard the tomb of his master for like some 15 years or something until he died. And she heard about this story, and she commissioned that very famous statue that's on the bridge. And people go and they rub, I think they rub his nose or they rub his paws or something. It always gets really shiny. So that was Angela Burdett Coutts who put that there as well. And she's funding lifeboats to the RNLI. She funds schemes that she reckons are going to benefit mankind. So she funded David Livingstone on his African explorations. And someone who we talked about in, I don't know if it was maybe the first podcast we did. When did we do Ada Lovelace? It was very early on, wasn't it?
Maybe the fourth or fifth.
No, possibly. I can't even remember now. But early on. So one of the people that she bankrolled as well was Charles Babbage, who, of course, worked closely with Ada Lovelace in the development of the first computer. And she was friends with these people as well. She'd get Charles Babbage, Michael Faraday, people like this. They would come and meet her in her father's home, and she would talk about science with them, you know, incredibly interested and interesting lady. And she would talk about science and be really, really fascinated. And she provided financial backing for Babbage's calculating engine, which, as we know, is the sort of forerunner to, you know, computing, really.
Wow. And I wonder if, you know, if she had somebody by her side who was kind of helping her choose certain charities and companies and people to help out, because it sounds like she was just non-stop.
Yeah, it does. And there's a lot of, well, so in terms of people by her side, so you've got her father, okay, so he is advising her on what charities to look at, but she's talking to a lot of people, actually. So she's talking to her father. She's talking to, there's another lady called Hannah. Hannah was her governess. She was only a little bit older than Angela. And so it was her stepmother who left her the money, brought her in as a governess. And they got on really, really well. And actually, Hannah and Angela lived next door to each other for their whole life. And even when Hannah married, she had the house next to Angela. So they were very, very close. She also had people like, she was very friendly with the Duke of Wellington. He would, you know, give her advice on
suggest people.
Yeah. So there's a lot of people she'd be chatting to. And I tell you, one of the biggest people that she chatted to is somebody that you may have heard of. He's not very well known. He's a guy called Charles Dickens. Heard of him?
Charles Dickens. It's not ringing any bells, actually, no.
So she and Charles Dickens were really, really good friends, really very close. And they met for the first time in 1839 at the home of a guy who was involved in the running of Coutts Bank. And it seems like Dickens was really taken with her. He wrote her a letter and he said, I haven't done anything since I met you that has been of any importance to me. So he was obviously quite taken with
her.
And she seemed pretty taken with him as well. One of the creepy things I read is that he gave her beauty advice on her skin. He like I say, beauty was not her best advantage or best strongest attribute, which, to be fair, doesn't matter at all. But, you know, of course it did back then. And so he would give her advice on how to make her skin better and all this stuff. Whatever. Anyway.
That's a bit strange, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought that Charles Dickens was the kind of person you'd go to for skin advice.
I don't think she went to him. I don't suspect it was solicited advice. I suspect it was
he was just
unsolicited
probably
by men deciding how women should be. But anyway, let's not dwell on that. But one of the things he did is in 1843, he approached us. So they met at this this dinner party, and they stayed friends, and they would write to each other an awful lot. They were very, very close friends, and they would kind of go tootling around London and looking at certain areas and the poverty and you know, using that to sort of spur them on. And in 1843, Dickens came to her with an idea about ragged schools. Do you know what ragged schools are?
Yes, they're a little bit like blue coat schools. So they educate poor children.
Yeah, essentially they're giving, and it's secular education as well. It's not religious education, so it's for the very, very poor. It's all free education. And it's about, yes, philanthropy essentially. And Dickens had given a little bit of money to one of those schools, but of course he doesn't have the kind of money that Angela does, and he asks her if she'd be interested in supporting, and she really is. So she invests quite a bit of money, and she builds these public baths for them and a larger schoolroom and all this kind of thing. And she works actually very closely with another chap who's giving her advice, Lord Shaftesbury, who we know as a philanthropist as well.
Yes.
Shaftesbury Avenue, named after him, all that kind of thing. And he had started up this union of these ragged schools. And so she supports him with that as well. And she finances quite a lot of them. And for the next 8 to 10 years, well over 200 of these schools are set up in the UK for these poor children, which is a really, really big deal. But her link to Dickens doesn't stop there. So a few years later, a few years after this, in the mid-1840s, Dickens is getting his knickers in a twist about... Because, I mean, the good thing about Dickens is that, you know, nobody is all good, nobody is all bad. And we know that Dickens has a little bit of a rocky history with his wife and all this sort of stuff. So he's not an absolute angel. But he one of the things is he's come from poverty. He's seen it. He sees what the effects are. He's seen what it's like, what it does to families and this kind of thing. And so he writes to Angela and says, look, I've got this plan. I'm seeing all these women and girls working on the streets as prostitutes. And I really want to give something, some kind of place, some building where we can essentially rehabilitate them is essentially what he wants to do. Get them off the streets, give them some training, give them some dignity back, and support them to sort of then go out and live their own lives, really.
Hmm.
And he had this idea to create a home, if you like. He called it an asylum. An asylum, I think, is what we would now think of as something a little bit like Bedlam that we spoke about a few weeks ago.
But it's actually, quite a negative word, isn't it?
It is quite a negative word. And of course, there are, you know, especially in this period, there are lots of very negative ideas about the women who are prostitutes because they are seen as fallen women and all this kind of thing. So I guess there was a negative element, but really an asylum, it's more about, well, there's a French word, asile, which is, you know, asylum in terms of looking after people, really, you know.
Refuge.
Yeah, it's the same as if somebody seeks asylum. It's about giving them cover, giving them safety. So that's mm-hmm. what it's more that thing rather than the sort of an asylum the way that we might think.
Yeah.
And he says, right, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to split into two. I reckon we can do about 30 women, and they come in. It's going to be religion-based. That must be the basis of the whole thing. And I'm going to bring them in, and they go into the first section, and there's sort of probation area. And if they pass that through kind of good conduct and all this sort of stuff, they then progress into the second section, which is then called, you know, he's called it the society of the house, essentially.
Okay.
Now, Angela is very aware of this because she lives on Piccadilly and she's seen them up and down the street every night, you know, in that area. And one group that is particularly vulnerable, this is something you don't always think about, are young female servants. There's obviously a lot of young women who are in service. And there is as well, there's kind of this idea that they go from job to job, but realistically their jobs are not safe, and they can do something really small and the master of the house can say, you're out, go, that's it. And then what do? So some of them between jobs are forced really into prostitution or something like that, just to survive really, which is a real shame. So that's one of the options. And if they don't get good character references and all this kind of stuff, well, you know, it's all a bit, it's not going to happen. So yeah, it's all a bit tricky really. And one of the people that says, oh, I don't really don't think you should get involved in this, is the Duke of Wellington. But she says...
He says that to her. He says that to Angela. Yeah,
he says, I'm not sure about that. He says, I don't think it's a good idea. But she kind of says, oh, I don't really... Nah, that's fine. I'm going to do it. And so she does. She agrees to fund this proposal, which he says is going to cost about £700 a year, which nowadays is around £50,000 a year. So it's a good chunk of money. It's definitely a very good chunk of money. So
this is to create not one, but how many did he?
One.
Oh, just yeah. one. So yeah, that's to fund one a year. Yes. 30 with 30 women.
With 30 women, that's the plan. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. So it's, you know, there's a lot of money going in there. And she yeah. so she says fine. And they originally planned to build somewhere, but then they realised that actually it's probably a lot cheaper to find somewhere that's already built and use that one that's already there. And that's what they're going to do. So he needs to find somewhere. And she kind of says, you know, I'll give you the money. You go do it. You sort it. Absolutely fine. And he needs to get a house. He needs to get a matron and assistants and staff and all this kind of stuff. He realised pretty quickly that 30, taking in 30 is not that practical. But he finds this cottage or this house called Urania Cottage. He calls it the home because he wants it to be like a home.
Okay.
And he opens it in 1847. And he starts publishing this leaflet, which he's giving out to women that he's finding in the streets, encouraging them to apply to join this place. And every young woman who responds to the leaflet, he interviews. And some people actually recommend people. They could be prison workers or the police. And they say, we've got this person who might be right for it. And he would then interview them and potentially accept them. And once they'd been accepted, the condition was that you were not to mention your past anymore. The matrons would not be informed about it either.
Oh, as soon as you entered?
As soon as you entered, yeah. Okay. You've got to, that's it. You sort of draw a veil over that part of your life and you're not to talk about it and that kind of thing. Right. And it was opened in 1847, in the winter of 1847. And it started with four women and two more came in the following week. And they, I think they could take about 8 to 10 maximum, I think, is around that. And they would sleep 3 or 4 to a bedroom. They'd each have their own bed. And it was quite regimented. They'd be up at 6. They had to make their beds. They actually sort of had to inform if anybody was hiding booze or anything like that. They had twice daily prayers. Although Dickens was quite keen on not making it really sort of, you know, lash whipping. It wasn't supposed to be about you've done wrong and repent. Mm. It was more about trying to get them kind of onto what he saw as the straight and narrow, really.
Okay.
So he's not asking them to sort of do lots of heavy, you know, repenting and moralising and all that sort of stuff. But there's a religious element to it. And some of the people they had there were needlewomen who were starving. They had violent girls who'd been imprisoned. They'd had girls from ragged schools. A whole variety of different people. People who'd been done for shoplifting. Even 2 women who had been locked up for attempting suicide. Which is quite interesting because, of course, suicide was a crime.
It would have been just, I mean, so this is 1847, and Charles Dickens, you know, he was pretty famous during his lifetime, isn't he?
Yeah.
So people would have sat down with him to be interviewed by him. That must have been quite peculiar.
Yeah, it really would, wouldn't it?
And I guess after all of these interviews, he would have known so much about life on the streets for women. And I guess that's why in his novels he has quite a lot of empathy for women.
It does, I think. And, you know, he grew up in, we could do a whole different one on Dickens. And, but he grew up in an area, well, his father was in debtor's prison and he was going through some of the very poor areas, which is where he writes all these things from. And, the plight of women is something that didn't escape him. He's a very astute chap, you know. So there we go. So, in terms of what they're doing there, it's almost like when I was reading up about it sounded like boarding school. They had 3 meals a day. They were given clothes to wear. They weren't allowed out on their own. The matron would take them out in kind of groups, or, you know, the two of them or whatever. They weren't allowed unsupervised visits or anything like that, or even really correspondence, because Dickens was really worried that they were going to be dragged back into their old lives and things like that. They were given marks for good behaviour and they'd lose marks for bad behaviour. And those marks were worth money. And so when they could save them up, and so when the time came to leave, they could then sort of switch over their marks for money, and they would have money to leave and go and do that. And if they caused trouble, they'd be kicked out and all that kind of thing. And so, yeah, it's quite a it's quite a regimented thing. But the aim is to get people not to sort of keep them there like they're a prisoner. They could leave if they wanted to leave. They could go. But to sort of give them some kind of structure. And then hopefully after a year or so, they'd then be able to go out and start their own home or whatever it might be. And actually, a lot of the time, when they left, the aim was to get them on a migrant ship going to Australia.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that was sort of the plan. Is when they went in, they knew that the deal was, you know, we get you sorted, you're all good to go, and we'll then pop you on a boat over to Australia, and you can start a new life over there.
Gosh, it's quite risky, isn't it? You know, to suddenly put the women on the boat and be like, well, I don't know if Dickens travelled to Australia himself, but not really know.
Yeah.
Much about the land that they were about to go to.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, but by this point, you know, Australia is not just being sent, you know, all the criminals are being sent there. It's now being populated by Western, by British and other Westerners, and you know, it's now a good place to go. It's people kind of migrating rather than being sent there as a punishment.
And I guess it's that mental thing where it's like, as soon as you leave here, you are going to a better land. You are getting out of the place that you associate with, you know, your bad times.
Yeah. And as well, you know, if you come out of their home and you stay in London, very shortly, surely your old,
your habits,
mates, or your old pimp or whatever, they're going to find you, and then you're going to be back to where you are. So I suppose if you take yourself completely out of the situation, then
yes.
And like I say, he did actually, you could get expelled if you were deprived of, decided to kind of go off the rails a little bit. You could be kicked out. There was one lady, well, in fact, there were a few people that got kicked out. There was one lady called Isabella Gordon. She'd caused a few problems for one of the staff there. And if they were kicked out, then they'd take back all of the nice clothes they'd given them. And so when she left, she didn't have any clothes of her own. She had one dress on and in one of the really rough shawls, and they gave her a little bit of money to get a night's lodging. And then the girl realizing that she's been kicked out and actually her chance has gone, she apparently just broke down in tears. And she, when she got out of the door, she stopped and she leant against the house for a good few minutes, just crying her eyes out before she went to the gate. And then when she went out the gate, stood there for a little while, and then apparently they saw her kind of going off down the street, and she was crying and wiping her face with her shawl. Really awful. And Dickens knew that, of course, given that, she's probably going to be back in prostitution in a couple of days. But if she's not going to abide by the rules, he's not going to keep her there, which is
quite... We just let her walk up. God, Dickens, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it said that actually that lady, Isabella Gordon, was the inspiration for a lady in David Copperfield called Martha Endell.
Oh, I love that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, who, again, you know, goes back to her life as a prostitute. And it says, I think, you know, in the book, she says she gets up and she puts her shawl around her and stops and then cries and then wipes her face in the shawl and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, the inspiration.
Yeah, possibly.
I'm going to have to revisit that book.
Yeah, really interesting. So this home, they... it closes in, when does it close? About 1856, I think, somewhere around there. And the first inmate goes off for Australia in 1849, the very start of 1849, so she's done just over a year. And they get through about 56 or so women at the time. And they reckon, so a handful of them left of their own accord, a few were expelled. And they reckon that of the 56, about 30 of them went on to have a very fulfilling life. They got married and had a decent life. Some, of course, you know, went back into prostitution, but about 30 of them, which I would say for the time is probably pretty decent odds.
That's a good percentage, I'd say. That's good.
Exactly. Now, they also did this. So I mentioned earlier that Angela Burdett Coutts was involved in rebuilding Bethnal Green, that kind of area. And that was also with Charles Dickens, at least to start with. And they went and they kind of visited all these model homes, model buildings that were in existence for the kind of clearing of slums and giving up, you know, giving buildings to people who were poor. And they started planning the rebuilding of the East End a little bit. It was Dickens who suggested Bethnal Green. If you read Oliver Twist, that's where Nancy is from. So he's got these links to it as well. So... when did I say that Urania Cottage closed down?
1850.
Oh, that's wrong. It's 1862.
1862.
Just remembered. So now Urania Cottage closes down because Angela breaks off contact with Charles Dickens and she stops funding Urania Cottage.
Oh, what's Dickie done?
Well, we do know that Charles Dickens is, he has a very turbulent relationship with his wife. And of course he has a mistress and it all goes a little bit wrong. And it's all very public, this affair that he has and this breakup of his marriage. And it is so public and it's very much kind of washing your laundry in public that quite a few people get very sniffy about it, including Angela. And she finds it really quite unbecoming that this is happening. And so she decides, actually, I'm sort of done here. And she not just backs off from Urania Cottage, but she breaks off contact with him completely. And they don't really, they're not really friends anymore.
And and this includes not giving him any more money to fund his idea.
Exactly. She still does go forward with the Bethnal Green thing, but she does it on her own.
Okay.
And she still does all of that, but it's not involving Charles Dickens anymore.
Wow, it's so interesting, isn't it? And when you started, you know, talking about her connection to Charles Dickens, I was thinking, God, is this suddenly going to go sour? Is Charles Dickens actually kind of going to be a maniac in this home for women?
No. I mean, it all seems very above board and very, you know, really quite noble, actually.
But I guess she has to be careful, doesn't she? Because she's helping so many people and she needs to be... She can't basically be seen with somebody who is, you know, not looking good in society.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And she does have a couple of, you know, she gets, I mean, of course, you're doing things at a very high level philanthropically. And realistically, the only other people doing that, or the majority, are men. So she has quite a lot of male friendships. One including, as I mentioned, the Duke of Wellington. I'm going to come back to this this story from when I started. I told you about him earlier, but I'm going to revisit it here because it's a really interesting friendship. They're very, very close. There's quite a massive difference in age. When she is 30, he is 75. So there's really quite a massive difference in age. But again, you know, he's got he's in those higher echelons, she's hanging out with him, and they write an awful lot. And when they hang out a lot, but when they're not together, they write sometimes twice a day to each other. And they reckon that during their friendship, they write each other about 800 letters.
When has the Duke of Welly got time?
I know!
You know, because he wasn't just on the front line for Waterloo. It was...
Well, this is obviously later in his life. So
he's 70 odd. He's hung up his Wellington booze.
Yeah, he's sort of herring around the countryside in fast
food. Wow. I mean, he was a bit of a naughty one. He had quite a few mistresses, didn't he, the Duke of Welly?
Yes, I think he did. No, did he? Oh, do you know what? I'm not too sure. I can't remember. It's been so long.
I think he did. I know one was a woman called Harriet Wilson.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. This is interesting because there is possibly something between them. So they're writing all these letters, but they're also sending each other little gifts. They'll find things on their walks, and as they find stuff, cute. You know, like a flower or something. It's really quite sweet, isn't it? Maybe we should start doing that.
We should kind of like leave little pebbles for each other that have got little pictures painted on them.
They send this to each other, which is rather nice. And there's a speculation that he was possibly her lover.
Okay.
The letters have, you know, they're very, very close, very, very close letters. There's definitely something very, very close there.
There was 75. I mean,
there's even a rumor that they were secretly married in both families. Actually, that there is. Rumours that apparently still exist that they were secretly married. There's no proof of that marriage, though. There is no proof. But we do know that in 1847, Angela Burdett Coutts proposed to the Duke of Wellington.
Gosh. He was
33 at this point.
I do understand it because she's been having so many people that have probably got down on one knee and she just can't trust them.
Yeah.
But she can trust the Duke because he has his own money. He has his own title.
Yeah.
He's of an age where he's not going to be just marrying her for the sake of it.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. And I guess the Duke obviously says no.
Yeah, he turns it down very gently. And he writes a lovely letter. And he says, my first duty towards you is that of friend, guardian, protector. So maybe there was an attraction there for him. We'll probably never know. But ultimately, he felt that his... And he did mention the age difference as well in the letter. And he sort of says, I feel like you've got 20 good years ahead of you kind of thing. And
so this is all her. She's wanting an older man.
And he may have done that. But he might also have just thought, you know, while I do want that, it's not the best for you. And turned it down because he does mention
good old
about
Arthur.
Yeah, good on him, good old Welly.
Yeah.
Another man she is very close to is Michael Faraday. So there's all the big dogs coming out.
Gosh, all the big dogs.
And if people don't know who Michael Faraday is, he was a bit of an experimental genius at the time. He worked with light and magnetism and all this sort of stuff. And again, because she is so interested in science and something that her father again kind of encouraged her to be interested in things like that. He wasn't really sociable, Michael Faraday. He didn't really like all the big sort of social scene, but he loved hanging out with her. They would meet, they would discuss stuff, really, really interesting. And eventually, after the Friday lectures at the Royal Institution, he would kind of come to her afterwards and tell her everything that he'd learned in these lectures. And he encourages her to apply for membership of the Royal Society.
Oh.
She does, and she becomes a full member of the Royal Society in 1847.
And was there many female members at the time?
Not at all. Very much not. So there we go. So she's got these really interesting friendships. And realistically, you know, all of this is going on alongside her philanthropy, which is just immense. And so I've told you some of the things she's done. And it seems that one of her biographers said that she never really thought she was done when it came to helping people. And she's clearly not motivated by fame. She doesn't care about it.
No.
Nothing that she's doing is big ticket. Well, some of them are, you know, a bit like the Crimea and stuff, but she's not doing it for fame. And one of the ways we know this is that there's a lot of stuff that we don't know what she gave the money to. She's got all these logbooks of where the money has gone to. And sometimes she's simply written an amount, however many pounds, and next to it, it's just written donation. No details of where
it
went.
Only she knows.
Yeah. So we'll probably never know where a lot of that stuff went. It's incredible.
Wow.
And in her lifetime, it's believed that she donated the equivalent of £350 million. Yeah.
And how much, because I was going to say, did her money ever dry out? You know, did she have money in her will to give to another Coutts member?
Now, this is where it gets even more interesting, if that's even possible. So firstly, I just want to, before we go on to the next interesting bit, I do want to say that, you know, all of this didn't go unnoticed. Queen Victoria makes her a baroness in recognition of all of this. So, you know, there is a little bit of recognition there, which is rather nice, but nothing that she was, you know, searching for, whatever. So do you remember a certain clause in the will? Things that she couldn't do if she wanted her.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So she couldn't marry somebody that was foreign.
Yep.
And oh, what else was it?
That's
it
the had only to, one we need.
That's the only one we need. There we go. Yeah.
So she hasn't married. Okay. She's decided not to marry. She's not interested in it at all until she gets to the age of 66.
Oh.
Now, so this money, the condition that she has this money. And so I think I mentioned it was about 165 million that she inherited. And she's given away 350 million. So, of course, that isn't, you know, some of the money that she's got, but also the interest and all the stuff, because, of course, it's in the bank. So it's doing very well, you know, all that money. So she gets to 66 and she meets a chap who is 29. So she likes the age gaps.
She does, doesn't she? Wow.
And he is called William Ashmead Bartlett.
Okay.
And he is, Ashmead is his mother's name. His father died when he was really young and he grew up in Torquay. And all of his four grandparents were English and all this kind of stuff. And Queen Victoria said that it was a mad marriage. She really wasn't behind it. Bearing in mind, Queen Victoria's friends with Angela Burdett Coutts, and she says it's absolutely mad. And it's quite a scandalous marriage in society. She's 66. She's not what they would term a looker. And this guy is 29 years of age. But he grew up in Torquay. He's lived in England all of his life, except for the first 2 years of his life when he was born in America.
Oh, my God, a foreigner.
So to all intents and purposes, he's British. His grandparents are British. His parents are British. But he just so happened to be born in America, therefore has American citizenship.
Okay.
And that means that she's going to lose her inheritance overnight. Yeah. She doesn't care.
She knows that. I mean, at the end of the day, she's been kind of, you know, not throwing it around, so to speak, but, you know, giving so much away that it was never about the money for her, was it?
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was in terms of being able to do stuff with it.
Exactly. And to be able to go, do you know what? I feel like I've done my duty. But then no, because you said that she always felt that she could do more.
Yeah. So she marries William. And it turns out that this is not a marriage. You know, he's not marrying her for her money, because, of course, he knows as well that this is going to happen. It seems to be a marriage of love, and they are married for 25 years, really, really happily.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, from 66 all the way through till she dies at 92, they're married.
So I wonder what happens to William. Does he marry again?
Joe, I don't know. I didn't go into William. I'm not as interested in him. I'm more interested in
her. Let's forget William.
He may well have done. I mean, he would have been what?
40-something.
Well, no, he'd have been slightly just over 50, I think, wouldn't he? No, over 40. No, oh, God, I can't do maths. 29. Just over 50. Yeah.
Middle-aged. Like
interesting. So
wow. And I'm just so happy that she found love.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all those people knocking at her door who just wanted her money, you know, that must have been so off-putting. And the trust that she had in men probably was quite low.
Yeah, I mean, she obviously waited for the guy that she was supposed to be with, which
that she just knew. And it's quite fairy tale like, isn't it? Because it's like, if you really do love me and you want to be with me, be aware that when you marry me, all of the money will be gone.
Exactly.
So if you really love me, I'll see you down the aisle. And he's there. And she's like, oh my God.
It's lovely, isn't it?
It's really lovely.
Yeah. So this inheritance transfers over to her sister. Clara.
So her sister's like, finally.
Wait,
66 bloody years.
And her sister, and I think this is really lovely. I think partly, I mean, I don't know the reasons behind this, but I would love to think that it's because when Angela was inherited the money, she gave her sisters an allowance and everything that she's done philanthropically. But Clara gives her £16,000 a year.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So
I mean, which is not a huge amount given, you know, her status, but again, like you say, for her it's not about the money. She allows herself a budget of about £1,000 a month for household expenses and stuff.
Gosh, what's she buying? Well, I mean, this is
late 1800s, isn't it? But so that she doesn't have much left for charity, but what she does have, she does still give to charities. And she's got kind of stocks and shares and things that she gives to her husband and stuff like this. He becomes a member of parliament, actually, for Westminster.
Wow.
Interestingly. And so they live very, very happily in her house in Stratton Street, in just off Piccadilly. And in 1906, at the grand old age of 92, she dies of bronchitis.
Mm.
And she was such a big deal that her body, she lay in state for 3 days at their home. And about, well, reports vary, but somewhere in the region of 30,000 people actually come by to pay their respects.
In 3 days?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. I mean, the help and the people that she touched and... Yeah. God,
yeah,
I'm so shocked and a little bit annoyed at myself that I don't, I before this, I didn't really know her.
And can I tell you, the story's not over yet.
Really?
Yeah. It's amazing. So she dies at the very, very end of 1906, so 30th of December. So she's buried very early 1907. And it gets even better with her funeral. So she has this huge parade of people coming past, and she was known as the Queen of the Poor. Which I think is rather lovely.
Queen of the Poor.
Yeah.
Wow, what a title.
Oh, it's great, isn't it? And so because of her status and because of the fact that she is utterly incredible, the Dean of Westminster says, well, look, we've got a space in the Abbey, Westminster Abbey, for her. Originally, she wanted to be buried. If you remember her friend Hannah, who was her governess and then her longtime friend who'd already died by this point, she originally wanted to be buried alongside Hannah. But when Dean of Westminster said, we've got the Abbey, her husband was like, yeah, pretty cool. So... the trick was the Abbey was no longer burying full bodies. It was cremations only. And he said to her husband, she has to be cremated first. And her husband was like, yep, fine. But had absolutely no intention of having her cremated. And the day before the funeral, not only had she not been cremated, he's also not going to cremate her either. Mm-hmm. And so she has a smaller plot because it was supposed to be ashes. And he had seen how... there was an actor called Henry Irving who'd had quite a small coffin with an urn of ashes inside, and so he was like, well, we'll just do that instead. So he wanted to fit it into a really narrow grave in the Abbey. Now, I did read, and I haven't actually verified this, so I'm going to take this slightly just, you know, as is, but I'll need to double check it. I did read that she was buried in quicklime without a coffin instead.
Oh.
I don't know if that's 100% true. I read that somewhere and I meant to double check it, but I didn't quite get around to that. So that is a possibility. I need to double check that. But she's buried very close to Lord Shaftesbury, who is that other philanthropist that we mentioned earlier.
I've never seen her grave.
No, it's up more towards the west end, up towards the west door, up that way somewhere.
Oh, my goodness, yeah, me.
I know. And the amount that her husband spent on it was huge. It was, again, one of those things where... because she was such a big deal and she had friends in the royal family and all this stuff, the service was attended by royalty, but also people who had benefited from her philanthropy, people from the East End. So you've got the entirety, you know, the gamut of people that whose lives she's touched really goes from the top to the bottom. Not that I'm saying that people are at the bottom, but you know what I mean, in terms of all that, you know, class and money and all that kind of thing. And so, again, it's this melting pot of everybody who's at her service, although... The chaps who are in charge at the Abbey, the dean and stuff, are quite peeved about him and the non-cremation thing, so they don't actually go. And he paid a huge amount of money for the funeral. He paid about £266, which today would be around £30,000 to £32,000 for the funeral, which was only about 50 quid less than the funeral for the King Edward VII had been.
Whoa.
Yeah. So as a result, her body, not just her ashes, her body does lie in the Abbey as well.
Again, just showing that William, her husband, was just such a great guy.
Right? He's so good. He's so good. And Edward VII describes that. And I think this is possibly the best description of her. After my mother, she is the most remarkable woman in the kingdom.
Oh.
Which is lovely, isn't it?
That is really lovely.
And she does have a bit of a legacy. So the Coutts Bank have a thing called the Coutts Foundation, which is an independent charity that is supported by Coutts. And its aim is still to tackle poverty in communities where the bank has a branch or something like that. And one thing in particular, they are very, very strongly linked to St Martin's in the Fields Church, which is just a couple of minutes walk from the bank itself, the main one on the Strand. And St Martin's in the Field have a very big, very important homeless charity that's there. And so Coutts support that and have given on that. Well, their website says since 2017, so the last sort of 5 years, they've given about £400,000
wow.
to that alone. and the staff raise and raise funds and things like that, and they volunteer there as well. So, you know, her legacy is very much one of philanthropic nature, and particularly combating poverty. She's just wonderful.
Wow, I am so impressed with this lady. I don't even know what she looks like.
We'll put a picture on our Instagram.
We'll put a
picture for Emily now, because she looks a bit sort of, she almost looks a little bit school mommy.
It's all right, I've got one here. Oh, no, it's a show in Angela Coutts in 2020. I don't think that's her.
Maybe not. There's a lovely picture of her. I mean, most of the pictures of her are a bit older. But there's one of her younger where she's really rather sort of elegant and sort of reclining and looking rather very thoughtful.
Oh, there she is. I would say that she is a very beautiful woman.
I mean, I think so. And there's a picture of, there's a painting, not a picture, but a painting of her getting married as well. And it's really rather funny because I'm just going to share my screen with Emily so she can see this picture right here of the marriage. And she's sort of, the guy's painted her staring at what would be the camera, essentially.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, amazing. She was dressed in white velvet for her wedding as well, which would have looked absolutely brilliant. Lace, old lace as well.
Amazing. Alex, thank you so much.
Angela Burdett Coutts. What a woman. Wow. I think this is going to be one of the longest ones we've done so far. But could have probably done an entire podcast on just Urania Cottage, because there's so much interesting stuff with that. But I decided to.
Wow.
Podcast Pedestal.
Gosh, I mean, there's quite a few things there for podcast pedestal.
Yeah. I wasn't quite sure, because I was thinking about this today about, what am I going to pick? And I'm not sure. Like, there's so many things.
I thought I knew, but then at the end, you said something and I thought,
I just love how many chapters there are to her.
Go for that.
How many completely separate chapters to her life there are, and just how she defies convention at every end and turn.
That's it as well. I'm very tempted to go for her proposing to the Duke of Wellington.
Ooh, yeah.
Because, as you say, it's, you know, in terms of how she did so many things as a woman that you just would not expect her to do.
Yeah.
To propose to a man back then, and not only a man, but the Duke of Wellington, to have the balls to be like, I'm gonna propose. Who are you gonna propose to? The Duke of Wellington. Yeah. Really?
Yeah, the armed forces, whatever, yeah.
Good luck with that. I think I might have to go for that, because it just shows the gumption.
Yeah.
But I'm also quite tempted by the quote at the end.
Yeah, good quote.
What are you thinking?
Well, I think having sort of not known what I was going to pick all week, I think in the last 2 minutes it's solidified in my brain what I want to pick. And it's really something super small. And you're going to laugh at me, because there's so many things that are probably worth picking. I'm going to pick the entrance in her log that is sort of undisclosed donations.
Oh, that's a good one.
Is it though? It's a bit weird. It's a bit weird, but because I just think, for me, I just love her. She's utterly brilliant. And the fact that, because so many people would have done it. This is the thing, you know, you talk about philanthropists, and if you say, oh, somebody, you give a philanthropist name, someone will go, oh yes, they did this, or oh yes, they did that. And you don't hear about Angela Burdett Coutts, because she did so much that you kind of can't pin her down to anything. And I love the fact that for her, it wasn't about fame and it wasn't about having her name attached to anything. And if she just thought that somebody over there needed a bit of cash, she'd put it in her logbook. She'd note it down, but she wasn't that bothered about logging it for posterity, or maybe even just not, didn't want people to know where it was going. And I love that. I love that thing of, I have this money, I want to do something right with it, somebody over there needs that bit of cash, I'm just going to pop it down. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't need recording for posterity. So undisclosed donations, I think, are going to be mine.
Undisclosed donations, I think that's a fantastic one. I think I'm going to go for the King's quote.
King's quote, yeah?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go for the King's quote.
I think that's a good one. I like that quote. I think it says so much about her.
It does. And the fact that it's coming from the king.
I know. Yeah. So yeah, I think, after my mother, she is the most remarkable woman in the kingdom.
Mm.
I think it's lovely.
That's beautiful. Yes, I'm going to go for that.
Bearing in mind that his mother, of course, is Queen Vic.
Yes, that's true. I mean...
There we go. Those are your options this week.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Alex.
King Edward VII's quote. And we've got, what we're going to call it, undisclosed donations. That sounds really rubbish. It's not going to win, but...
It's not smog taxi dudes, that's for sure.
Not smog taxi dudes.
Undisclosed donations, I think that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know how many, I can't remember how many letters the poll on Instagram
is. It's quite short, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. So there we go. So that's it for this week. That is, that poll will go up on Instagram at Ladies Who London Podcast on Sunday, and also on our personal podcast polls as well. Before we figure out what's happening next week, what have you got coming up, Em?
So, I still got my garden tour, which is on the 24th of April, 2 p.m.
Still?
Hour and a half. Still. I haven't decided it's going to be deleted. So if you want to do that, it's £10 per person, and you can find that on the londontourgroup.com. And also, if you go to the londontourgroup.com and you go to the tour shop, you'll see a list of walking tours, which include a legal walk, which include street art walk. We've got a Southwark walk. Have a little look on there and you'll see the different ones that we have.
Amazing. And does it say who the guide is? Because it's not always you, is it?
No, it's not. So the London Tour Group is myself and two other fantastic Blue Badge guides. So me, Emily, and another Emily as well, Emily Lawrence Baker, who's fantastic, and also Rowan Freeland.
Why is he not called Emily? Damn him.
I know, damn. We call him Emily, so it's fine.
Fabulous. Emily the third.
What about yourself?
So I'm really excited because this Sunday, my virtual tour series is kicking off with Curious Camden, which I'm thrilled about because it's an area that I really love. So that is going to be this Sunday, but it's the start of four virtual tours. You can do all four for £30 and get a watch back option as well. Or you can book them individually for £10. And it's Curious Camden. And then, she says, trying to remember what on earth the different tours are. Just going to vamp for a second here while I bring up my website. here we go, virtual tours. So we've got Curious Camden. I can't remember which order they're in. Then the next one. Yes, the next one is Behind Bankside, which is snippets of London's past. Really exciting little area. Then we've got Secrets of the City of London, all the little bits you walk past every day. And then after that is Best of Bermondsey, which is an area near where I live, which is lovely. So we're going to be looking at those. So those are all four. And my walking tours are now up on my website.
Yay!
My Harlots walking tour, street art. They're starting back on the 1st of May, and they're going to be pretty much every weekend. There's the odd weekend where I'm away doing something, but they're pretty much every weekend. Harlots, street art, we've got Women of Westminster, Black London, we've got Secrets of the City as well, Transatlantic Slave Trade. There's a whole variety of walking tours. I've got them up until I think the middle of June, and then when we get closer to that, I'll release more dates. But do come and have a little look. I'm so excited to get out guiding again. Can't wait.
Yay.
Fantastic.
The Wheel of Destiny.
So it's my pick for next week. So I'm going to get ready to spin the wheel.
Spin the wheel, baby.
I'm going to spin the wheel. Okay. And we're off. And, I thought the arrow was about to fall off then.
Don't break it.
It nearly span off.
That's so much work into it.
It's landed where the smog landed.
Mayfair?
Yes.
Which, in fairness, the smog wasn't linked to Mayfair.
Exactly. The smog wasn't linked to Mayfair. So I don't feel too bad.
That's all right.
Don't feel too bad. So Mayfair. Gosh, we've got the hotels. You've got... We've done the Mayfair. Many people that associate themselves with the area. Ooh, actually, I think I might go for Norman Hartnell.
Ooh, interesting. The Queen's designer for her wedding dress.
Yes. Yes. So there might be a few things in there, perhaps, about Prince Philip, too.
Oh, that would be quite nice, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So he lived in Mayfair and had his designer shop there as well. So
Norman Hartnell, not Prince Philip.
No. No. So, that's what I'm going to go for.
Yeah. Amazing. That sounds good. I like that. He's yeah, a bit of a mega dude. Is
yeah, it's a very interesting character.
Yeah. And that's it. There we go.
Okay, fabulous.
Fabulous. Well, listen, thank you everyone for coming and listening. Please do go and vote on Sunday if you have listened by then. If not, don't worry about it. and, or if not, too late. And we will see you next week talking about Norman Hartnell. But until then, have a wonderful week. Stay safe, stay sane. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week, everybody. Thank you very much.
Bye. Bye.